Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that battle space, there are a few men that I admire more and who have served more valiantly, certainly in the United States Congress of late, than our first guest. He is Congressman Louis Gohmert. He represents with true distinction the people of the 1st Congressional District, the great state of Texas. He chairs the Natural Resources Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, is a member of the Judiciary Committee, is the vice chairman of its Subcommittee on Crime, Terrorism, Homeland Security, and Investigations, and always a welcome guest here at Secure Freedom Radio. Congressman, welcome back. Good to have you, sir.
Always good to talk to you, Frank. Thank you.
I don't know where to begin. It is the true target-rich environment, but maybe we could start with your current thinking on the Benghazi scandal, Congressman. We, of course, just before the Memorial Day three-day weekend got underway, had a batch of emails that Hillary Clinton was involved with finally turned loose from the State Department to, I believe, the Select Committee on Benghazi. I know you haven't had a chance to read those, but from what you know about them, and more broadly, what you know about what was going on in Benghazi, is it fair to say that this is simply further reinforcement of the fact that there was real malfeasance taking place before, during, and after that attack on September 11th, 2012?
Well, we have known long before any emails were released, Frank, that the president and Hillary Clinton did not have the people, our own Americans, our own ambassador in Benghazi at the top of their concern list. Obviously, of more concern was the Las Vegas fundraiser the next day, and nothing needed to get in the way of that. And I do tip my hat to the president for his kind of mention of Benghazi the next day at the Las Vegas fundraiser and the big gathering there for his reelect, because he did mention them, you know, and so that was nice of him to mention them on the way to raising mass.
Yeah, it was on his mind.
He mentioned it in the middle of all the wild calls and hollering and clapping and applause. So it was nice of him to mention that we'd lost an ambassador. So
you're being just a little facetious, I know, Congressman, but this is really,
you know, you think?
What's appropriate given the kinds of outrages that we're seeing in this case.
And having become friends with family members of those who gave their lives, lost their lives. And actually, we had a couple on the rooftop that literally gave their lives. They knew what they were doing when they went up there. And one of the survivors from the rooftop had told me within 6 months after Benghazi that about exactly what had happened on the rooftop, and that these they knew when the first, there were three mortars fired, and they knew when the first one was fired, they had these guys zeroed in. They knew exactly the coordinates of what they were shooting for.
This was not a mob, in other words. This was not a spontaneous response to a video or anything
exactly.
else.
No, exactly. But so we knew that, and we knew the lies, and we knew that it took 20 hours or so, and the United States didn't send an appropriate plane to pick our people up. They sent a little private plane that's owned by somebody in another country that wasn't even big enough to get the gurney through the door without beating our wounded up coming in. So it was an outrage how they were treated. We knew that. We knew there could have been planes that got there in 3.5 hours and they didn't send them. We knew there were people that wanted to get there that were not allowed to get there. So we knew that there was absolute callousness in the face of our people being hit. And then, of course, we've found out since then there were, even Chris himself was asking for more security. He could see the problems coming.
Congressman, I know you feel passionately about this, and rightly so, and I think all of us should, given the true travesty of what happened there, the needlessness of it, and, of course, the lies that were told in its aftermath. Let me turn to a different topic, not unrelated, really, against the backdrop of an administration that has conducted itself in this fashion, not just in connection with Benghazi, but on, well, practically everything I can think of. It is extraordinary and astounding to me, and I know of great concern to you as well, that some in the leadership in the United States Congress have given the president a pass, or in some cases actually enabled behavior that is very, very problematic, notably with the action on this Corker-Cardin bill, as it's called. Can you talk a little bit about how you see it? What's happening inside the Congress at the moment that seems to be feeding into the president's lawlessness and disregard for our national interests?
Well, I don't know that I would say that what we're doing in the proposal by the Corker bill feeds into it. It just completely allows. It allows the president to be as lawless as he's being. So I guess one hand, you might say feeding, but I would say it just enables the president to keep doing what he's doing. But, you know, of all of the presidents that you would want to give more power and more flexibility to end up being able to trade and change immigration law unilaterally and do these kinds of things, I would think the last president you would want, given what we know now, would be this president. And I know there are many that I respect who are saying, oh, this is a great deal because it allows us, he has to bring these things before us and we get to approve them, and it's a good thing. Frank, the man has not provided information for things that have gone on during his whole presidency. They have been obfuscating, hiding, attacking.
The most transparent administration in history, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But they have done everything they can to keep us from getting information about what's going on. And when I've asked some of my friends in Congress who think it's a good idea, look, guys, do you think that passing one more law requiring him to provide us information is now, after 6.5 years, going to cause him to start giving us information when he's been violating the law right and left?
I have a bridge to sell them. I have a bridge to sell them. Congressman, let me turn quickly to one other thing.
He's been subpoenaed, and he won't even answer the subpoenas. So,
Congressman Louis Gohmert is our guest from the 1st Congressional District of Texas, and a man of strong feelings, which I admire and delighted to be able to share with our audience. Very quickly, Congressman, there's another story that I'm tracking that I'm alarmed by. Senator Dick Durbin, the number two Democrat in the House of Representatives, in the United States Senate, has led an initiative aimed at trying to bring 65,000 Syrians into this country, most of whom will be Muslim, and probably some number will be jihadist. What do you make of what's going on here, and should we be opposing this kind of initiative, not abetting it?
We ought to be extremely concerned. And by way of explanation, when I said he's been subpoenaed, his administration has been subpoenaed numerous times. We have been told repeatedly that the Syrians have been vetted, and we are providing aid to the vetted, moderate Syrian rebels. And yet we have seen stories, of, including quotes of these so-called vetted, moderate Syrian rebels, where they say, we stand with ICE, we're brothers, and we keep sending them weapons.
ICE being the Islamic State.
They're our enemies, but this administration cannot even vet who they want to send weapons, heavy weapons to, that keep ending up in the Islamic State hands. So I don't know how in the world we would trust them not to be bringing in Syrians who are rebels themselves that want to bring down our government. I think
that's especially so good when the FBI tells us that they can't, in fact, vet these people. It's lunacy. Congressman, we have to let you go. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Frank.
Our heart goes out to your folks who are suffering from the floods down there in Texas. Take good care, my friend. We'll talk with you again soon.
Thank you, Frank.
All the best. Next up, we'll drill down on what I call Senator Durbin's jihad caucus in the U.S. Senate with Ann Corcoran of Refugee Resettlement Watch. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
Over the past decade, while the American military and intelligence community have been engaged in a kinetic war overseas against a wide array of enemies aligned with the global jihadist movement, the Center for Security Policy has consistently shed light upon a dark and subversive effort that thrives nearly unopposed right here in this country, the one known by the Muslim Brotherhood as Civilization Jihad. In an effort to educate freedom-loving Americans about Civilization Jihad and how it has been waged against every facet of American civilization, the Center for Security Policy has, in 2015, begun publishing a series of monographs called the Civilization Jihad Reader Series. The first of these monographs is entitled Sharia in American Courts, and it documents how Sharia, divine Islamic law, which animates the global jihadist movement, has entered our very own court system. In this study, the Center documents how parties to litigation in American appellate courts have attempted to use Sharia to resolve 146 cases in 32 different states, potentially threatening the constitutional rights of our citizens, particularly women and children. The monograph not only highlights these cases, but the organizations here in America that are actively and successfully working to insinuate Sharia into our judiciary. Finally, it provides information on at least one antidote to this infirmity, a law that has been adopted in 8 states, one that protects our citizens against the use of foreign law and upholds our Constitution as the supreme law of the land, lest those who fight to defend our Constitution overseas do not come home to see it subordinated in a courtroom in their own home state. Learn more by reading Sharia in American Courts, which can be found on Amazon.com or the Center for Security Policy's website at www.securefreedom.org.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Jared Ogden, former Navy SEAL and member of Team Military on National Geographic Channel's Ultimate Survival Alaska. I want to tell you about an issue that you probably haven't heard much about. Thousands of America's veterans are suffering from occupational and environmental exposures that they were exposed to while serving in the military. We call these the toxic wounds of war. From Agent Orange and Gulf War illness to post-9/11 burn pit exposure and heavy metals in the air, and other toxic exposures that we don't fully understand. The Sergeant Sullivan Center is a powerful voice in our nation's capital, standing watch over these forgotten wounded. These men and women can't do it alone, and they need your help today. Every dollar raised by Sergeant Sullivan Center goes to medical research, public awareness, and advocacy. You can make a tax-deductible donation today at www.sergeantsullivancenter.org. That's SGTSullivanCenter.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Our guest is Ann Corcoran. She is the marvelous driving force behind an indispensable national resource. It's called Refugee Resettlement Watch. we turn to her for matters involving these very troubling developments in the refugee resettlement business, notably the issue that we talked about a moment ago with Congressman Louie Gohmert, namely the idea that Senator Richard Durbin, the number two Democrat in the Senate, is promoting to bring 65,000 Syrians to this country. Ann Corcoran, welcome back. It's always good to have you with us.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Thanks so much for having me.
So I've described this as the beginning of a jihad caucus in the United States Senate. What on earth are these 14 Democrats, led by Richard Durbin, Dick Durbin, thinking, as far as you can tell?
I love your name for the group. That's fabulous. Well, here's what's happening. The United Nations has said, and they've been saying it for a year, that they wanted the Western countries to take 130,000 Syrians into as refugees in the next, they wanted it in within this year that we're in right now. And they claim that since the U.S., has taken 50% of all the world's refugees in the past, that 50% of the 130,000 is, voila, 65,000 for us. They also have 11,000.
Now, why is that? We should take half of the entire allotment? Is for what reason?
Well, because traditionally the United States takes 50% of the world's refugees. I mean, we take, it's enormous.
You're kidding. I had no idea.
Oh, no, we take 50%. And so they've now taken that 50% and said, well, since we do that for all other refugees in the world, we should take 50% of the 130,000 that the United Nations is now selecting. They have selected 11,000 for us already that are already in the process of being submitted to the U.S. State Department.
Now, where are these folks currently, as best we can tell, Ann Corcoran?
Yeah, most of them are in the UN-run camps in Jordan, Turkey, and Lebanon.
Ann Corcoran is our guest. She runs the marvelous blog Refugee Resettlement Watch. And Ann, you first brought to my attention this letter from Dick Durbin and 13 other senators. No mention is made of the possibility that these folks might be, well, problematic, shall we say. When you mention that the UN runs these refugee camps, at least some in Syria, as best I can tell, are under the influence of outfits like the al-Nusra Front, if not the Islamic State itself. Are you concerned that some of these are people that might be, well, problematic to say the least?
Well, we should all be concerned, but first and foremost, the FBI is concerned. And there was testimony in the House Homeland Security Committee just in February by the FBI saying these refugees coming in from Syria cannot be properly screened. We don't know who these people are. And my research shows that the few we've brought already, which is less than 1,000, that 92% are Sunni Muslims.
There are a lot of Christians in Syria at the moment who are in refugee status. They are not the people that are being selected by the UN. You've written a book recently on this subject for the Center for Security Policy, a bestseller, let me add, at Amazon, as is the video that you have produced about it, a viral runaway hit. All of these, to your great credit, and Refugee Resettlement and the Hijra to America. Talk about this Hijra business and how that bears on whether Christians need apply for refugee status in this country these days.
Well, it's interesting. We've kind of ignored this whole concept of the Islamic doctrine of immigration until recent times. And Muhammad said for his followers to migrate and spread Islam across the world, and that's exactly what's happening. And the refugee resettlement program of the U.S. State Department is a significant piece of that.
Mm. It is indeed. And to the extent that they are pushing it, it, I guess, helps explain why it is that the Saudis don't seem to be taking any of these refugees at all. They're not targeted for this Hijra, evidently.
No, they don't need more Muslims, I think. No, Saudi Arabia does not take any refugees. Anybody who gets into Saudi Arabia is immediately put on a plane and sent back to whatever horrible place in the world they came from.
And this does seem to raise a question as both to the equitability of this arrangement, to say nothing of the advisability of it. You're describing, Ann Corcoran, a program that it seems is really engineered to bring Muslims to nations like ours in substantial numbers, and despite the fact, as you say, that the FBI can't attest to whether they are going to be jihadists or whether they're going to be, you know, upright citizens. But by and large, at least, they're coming out of communities in which Sharia is the law, and that almost certainly means that they're going to be a problem for us. You've also been tracking this phenomenon elsewhere in the country and involving other populations, and notably up in Minnesota. Talk quickly about your recent trip up there.
Yeah, I had a very interesting trip. I visited four towns in Minnesota and was able to meet lots of people who are very, very concerned, and that's about the Somali migration, which has now been going on for over two decades. We have brought over 100,000 Somalis to the United States, and they are still coming in at a rate of 700 or 800 a month, every single month, month after month, year after year, and there's really no reason for it. I'm sure your listeners are sitting there going, why are we even considering this in light of the fact that some of these young people that we even raised here on our dime are now going off to join Al-Shabaab or ISIS?
And presumably they're doing it for the purposes of honing their skills as jihadists. The question is, will they be allowed back into this country once they have mastered the craft of violent holy war against the American people? And another place where you've been raising an alarm is Spartanburg, South Carolina, represented by Trey Gowdy in the U.S. House of Representatives. I think in part as a result of the alarms you and others have been sounding, he has expressed some serious concern about what's going on. He asked the State Department to answer some 17 questions, as I recall, recently. Has he gotten a response, do you know? And what's the latest out of Spartanburg?
Well, he did get a response to the first 17 and felt that they were inadequate and sent another a bunch of questions, which I don't think he's had answered yet. One of the watchwords of this program is an enormous secrecy that goes on with these. We often call them resettlement contractors, but there are nine nonprofit groups that are really making the decisions as to which towns are going to get refugees and which won't. And so what we're having in Spartanburg is actually, it's really a watershed moment, to tell you the truth, because we're learning so much about the process. And Rep. Trey Gowdy is chairman of the subcommittee, and he could be holding hearings, the subcommittee responsible for the program, and he could be holding hearings anytime, and we urge him to do so, to review the secrecy that goes on with this program, which he's seeing firsthand in his district.
Yeah. This is, of course, the Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on Immigration and Border Security, as I recall. And
that's right.
It does seem as though this is crying out for some sort of oversight, and if not for the national interest, for certainly self-interest reasons, I would urge, as you have, Congressman Trey Gowdy, to take this matter on, not just with respect to Spartanburg, but the larger program about which you have been warning at Refugee Resettlement Watch so long and so well. We have to leave it at that, I'm afraid, for the moment. Ann Corcoran, thank you for your great work. Again, congratulations on the stupendous success of Refugee Resettlement, the Hijra in America. We'll look forward to talking with you further about all this in the near future. Next up, we'll be speaking with Gordon Chang about both the Chinese turmoil in the Pacific and what the North Koreans are up to. Straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
This is Frank Effney with the Secure Freedom Minute. It seems Congress has caucuses for just about every imaginable cause. Now the Senate has an informal jihad caucus led by its second-ranking Democrat, Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois. He's the man who wants Guantanamo Bay closed and its jihadists transferred to a prison in his state. He appears happy to rubber stamp President Obama's deal with Iran that will assure its jihadists get the bomb. Last week, Senator Durbin led 13 other Democratic senators in urging the president to bring 65,000 Syrian refugees to America. If past practice is any guide, these would be almost all Muslims from camps run by jihadists and selected by the Islamist-dominated United Nations. The FBI told Congress recently it couldn't vet such refugees. Let's tell Senator Durbin, no more jihadists. This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
On June 22nd, the Center for Security Policy will honor Representative Trent Franks of Arizona's 8th Congressional District and the mayor of Irving, Texas, Beth Van Dyne, at its annual Freedom Flame Award Dinner. The evening will take place at the exclusive Metropolitan Club of New York City. For tickets and more information, visit www.securefreedom.org.
Secure Freedom announces the launch of our newest initiative, the Counter Jihad Campaign, at counterjihad.com. We have gathered some of the foremost experts and activists to begin our fight back against those who long ago declared war on us. You can see our first two ads asking those who see something bad happening, like the attack in Garland, Texas, or the dozen jihadists at the Boston Marathon Killers Mosque, to say something. Join us and be a part of the Counter Jihad.
When we decided to rename this radio station, we came up with one word, one very big word, answer. That's because we know our listeners better than anybody. We know you wake up every day with an insatiable appetite for news and information. But more than that, you want to know what to make of it all. That's why we're here. Do this better than any station in town. Welcome aboard. AM 1260, The Answer.
This is Fred Fleisch for the Center for Security Policy. The Obama administration is portraying last week's raid by Army Special Forces that killed a top ISIS official as a big win in the war against ISIS. I agree that this daring raid was a big win, but I regret that it has been overshadowed by bad news in Iraq and Syria. The situation in Syria continues to deteriorate. ISIS and the Al-Qaeda-affiliated al-Nusra Front have gained so much territory that the Assad government is at risk of falling. The capture of the Sunni city of Ramadi over the weekend was a catastrophe for U.S. policy and the credibility of the Iraqi government. If ISIS is on the defensive, as the Obama administration claims, how could it pull this off after months of U.S.-led airstrikes? The answer is that President Obama still has no strategy to deal with ISIS in Iraq and Syria or to defeat the global jihad movement. I'm Fred Fleitz. Learn more at securefreedom.org.
This is Frank Effney. You're listening to AM 1260, The Answer.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. We are joined by our duty expert on matters involving Asia. He is Gordon Chang. He's graciously giving of his time each week to shed light on important developments and does so with the background of a man who reports on these matters for Forbes.com and for WorldAffairsJournal.com, for Fox News, of course, and many others as well. It's always a delight to have him with us, especially when there's some very, very important things developing, it seems, at the moment, both with respect to China and North Korea. Gordon, welcome back. It's good to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Frank.
Gordon, I'd like to start with this latest, well, sort of game of chicken, it seems, that the Chinese are about. Talk about this incident with one of our P-8 anti-submarine warfare aircraft that they harassed in the South China Sea this past week.
Last Wednesday, the Chinese challenged a P-8 Poseidon U.S. Navy reconnaissance craft over Fiery Cross Reef, which is in the Spratlys, which is in the southern part of the South China Sea. The plane was in international airspace. The Chinese warned it to veer away, and it mentioned a military alert zone that China had established, which is something new. So apparently China is infringing international airspace. Now, the Navy reconnaissance flight continued on, but clearly what the Chinese are trying to do is close off the South China Sea. And this is important because, as we've talked about before, U.S. foreign policy has always defended the global commons.
Right. And Gordon, is it your understanding that this military alert zone was over some of this real estate that the Chinese have reclaimed from the ocean floor, building essentially islands or atolls from which now to begin projecting power in just this way?
Yes, in the Spratlys, China has created something like 4 square kilometers of land since last year, or since the middle of last year. And what they're trying to do is to claim that these new features have a territorial sea up to 12 nautical miles, plus presumably they're also going to claim a 200-mile exclusive economic zone around each of these features. Now, this is a violation of China's obligations under the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea and also customary international law, which both provide that reclaimed features do not give rise to territorial waters or an EEZ. This is going to be important because just a few hours ago, the Chinese issued their white paper about how they're going to more aggressively defend open seas. And this brings China into conflict, not just with the United States, not just with its neighbors in the South China Sea, but indeed the whole international system.
Gordon Chang, were you surprised at the rather direct nature of the language in that white paper about their intentions vis-a-vis asserting sovereignty over much of that international water space in the South China Sea?
Frank, I was actually surprised that they issued the paper at this time. I thought that what the Chinese would try to do is diffuse the situation, largely because they realize that now there is a new view in the U.S. Navy as well as in Washington. But nonetheless, what they are doing is doubling down. We saw in the Global Times, which is a publication controlled by People's Daily, China essentially threatening war over the South China Sea. So this is going to indeed be the confrontation which I believe will determine the rules about what governs this century. We have a vision of this world. The Chinese have a competing one. Only one of them can prevail.
You know, it's interesting, Gordon, we've talked about this in the past. You've pointed out that China is a participant in a party to the Law of the Sea Treaty. We are not, as it happens. We've been importuned for years to get into it, but if ever there were a reason not to, it seems to me, it is the degree to which the Chinese have blithely ignored their obligations under it. And that's, I'm thinking, not just because we're not in it, that's because that's the nature of the Chinese regime. Gordon, one other development out of China that's gotten some headlines recently was the arrest in Southern California of 6 scientists attached to one of our academic institutions out there who are accused of espionage, economic espionage. Give us a sense of what this is all about and how are they being regarded by the folks back home?
Yes, also there is a arrest of another Chinese researcher just after that. You know, clearly China has run the most extensive program in the United States and elsewhere to obtain technology by any means possible, including espionage. In this particular case in California involving the 6 individuals, essentially what they were doing is taking U.S. technology and then trying to exploit it commercially back in China. This was a conspiracy from what was alleged. And I'm sure that, you know, this is ongoing. This has been going on for decades. And the United States has done very little about it up until recently, when there has been alarm in American circles about the wholesale theft of basically what we call the crown jewels, American technological prowess.
Gordon, we only have a couple minutes left. I wanted to sort of toss to you a couple of questions about North Korea and see if you could help us walk our way through them. We had the spectacle of a number of aging feminists, among others, massing at the North Korean-South Korean border and crossing by bus for the purposes of promoting the cause of reunification of the peninsula. I'd be interested in your thoughts about that. Also, Admiral Gortney, the commander of our North American Air Defense Command, warning that North Korea may now have perfected the technique of miniaturizing warheads sufficient to put them on missiles capable of reaching us from road mobile launchers in the Korean Peninsula. And finally, that there's an uptick in North Korean spying as well. It seems to be rather important to sustaining the regime. Give us your sense of what's going on in these cases and what they speak about more broadly about North Korea at the moment.
On Sunday, Gloria Steinem, 2 Nobel Peace laureates, and 27 other women crossed the demilitarized zone from North Korea to South Korea to, as you say, promote peace. Gloria Steinem, in particular, in an Associated Press interview, said that isolationism doesn't work. This is fascinating because they crossed at the Paeju crossing, western crossing, near the Kaesong Industrial Zone, Just a couple days before, on Wednesday, North Korea abruptly withdrew permission to Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, to use that very same crossing to go to the industrial zone to inspect it. This would have been the first UN Secretary General to do so. You know, it just shows North Korea is isolating itself. With Admiral Gortney, he's talked about a number of things, not only about the miniaturization of warheads, but also about the KN-08 road mobile missile being able to hit the west coast of the United States. This, of course, is an important development because the North Koreans have been getting a lot of help from the Chinese and perhaps from the Russians as well in order to be able to target American cities with the world's most destructive weapons. The United States has not had difficult conversations with the Chinese about this, from all I can tell. We need to do so. And, of course, the North Koreans have been spying on the United States. We've known this for quite some time. And, again, like the Chinese case, we have not confronted this issue to the extent that we should have. I think that now there's a sense of danger, and I believe that the United States will take a much tougher posture, not only against the North Koreans, but the Chinese as well.
Gordon, I'm told, interestingly enough, that this North Korean spying seems to be operating under the banner of the Unification Development Division in North Korea. Does that suggest that what these ladies were up to was sort of the serving as... agents of influence on behalf of the very people who are engaged in this kind of influence operation against us?
Lenin had the phrase, useful idiots. And unfortunately, that probably describes the Steinem delegation. You know, of course, everyone wants to see unification. Everyone wants to see peace. Everyone wants to have the best outcomes on the Korean Peninsula. The problem is that the North Korean regime has been preventing this. And Steinem did not actually talk about these issues in the terms that she should have. Also, a number of criticisms that have focused on her trip have been that they have not confronted the regime over the horrific plight of women to the extent that they should have. There was really nothing right about this delegation, and hopefully we'll be able to forget it. But nonetheless, it brings into highlight again that the problems are with Pyongyang, not with the rest of the international community.
Yeah. I guess I would just have as a caveat to that, the Chinese aren't necessarily so keen on reunification on South Korea's terms, as best I can tell. At least they haven't been all these years. And so they may not be quite as squared away on this as much of the rest of the international community. But otherwise, your point is well taken. Gordon Chang, as always, you are well taken. We're delighted to have you with us. Thank you very much for joining us. Come back to us again next week. Next up, we'll talk with Elaine Donnelly. We'll get a sense of whether the Israelis, among others, are putting women into ground combat and whether we should. More straight ahead.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
It's been over 7 years since a church group from another state brought a couple hundred refugees to the rural county where I live. I wanted to know, how could they do this? What was the governmental process that allowed the resettlement of refugees to a county ill-prepared to assimilate them? Employment opportunities were scarce. The health department was not familiar with illnesses and mental health problems of people who came from parts of the third world. The school system was not prepared to teach large numbers of students who didn't speak English.
That's author Ann Corcoran discussing her new book, Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement and the Hijra to America. She explains how Muslim immigrants are being quietly resettled into American towns without vetting them, even for terrorist links. Corcoran also explains how the global jihad movement is using immigration as a stealth campaign to spread its influence in America. You can read Federal Immigration Policy, Resettlement, and the Hijra to America on securefreedom.org or purchase a copy on amazon.com.
Hi, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real Special Forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real Special Forces, ours need ammunition. And in the War of Ideas, ammo is money. The center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its Special Forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
I'm Robert Muse, co-founder and senior counsel of the American Freedom Law Center, our nation's premier public interest law firm fighting for your faith and freedom in courtrooms across America. Make no mistake, we live in a pivotal time. Secular progressives such as Barack Obama and his surrogates are zealously sweeping religion from the public square, foisting Sharia law and other harmful international precedents into our courts and constitution, assaulting the traditional family, and weakening our national defense by, among other things, undermining the strength of our military through social engineering and political correctness. But I can assure you that the American Freedom Law Center is aggressively engaging our nation's enemies with offensive lawfare to defend our fundamental rights and to fight stealth jihad in all of its forms, including the civilization jihad being waged by Muslim Brotherhood front groups operating here in the U.S. Indeed, there is no other public interest law firm as uniquely qualified to fight this battle. But we need your prayers and financial support to succeed. Please consider a tax-deductible donation to support our critical fight for your faith and freedom. Visit us at www.AmericanFreedomLawCenter.org.
I'm Fred Fleitch with the Center for Security Policy. One of President Obama's worst foreign policy failings is the lack of a strategy to defeat Al-Qaeda and ISIS. These terrorist groups are part of a global movement to establish Islamic supremacy and Sharia through violence. This movement is called the Global Jihad Movement. It will not be defeated without a strategy that recognizes its true nature. In January 2015, we issued a comprehensive strategy to defeat the Global Jihad Movement. It is called the Secure Freedom Strategy and is based on National Security Directive 75, the strategy that President Ronald Reagan used to defeat the global totalitarian threat of his time, the Soviet Union. Like President Reagan's strategy, we lay out a comprehensive plan on how the United States government can be reorganized and focused to understand and defeat the Global Jihad Movement. You can read the Secure Freedom Strategy at securefreedom.org, or you can purchase a copy on Amazon.com. I'm Fred Fleitz.
This is Jenny Thomas. I do video interviews of leaders with the Daily Caller. I had the privilege recently of interviewing Diana West about her extraordinary new book, American Betrayal, The Secret Assault on Our Nation's Character. You can see it at dailycaller.com. American Betrayal reads like a spellbinding historical thriller, but it is also a carefully documented account of how the U.S. government was penetrated by communist agents in the years after President Roosevelt normalized relations with the Soviet Union. Diana West shows how a similar assault is being mounted today by yet another collectivist ideology, the supremacist Islamic doctrine of Sharia. She establishes that while the communists and the Islamists may have very different visions of the world, they have employed the same techniques to defeat America. Please watch my conversation with Diana West about American Betrayal, then check out the other great leaders we profile at dailycaller.com.
Annie Soldier Incorporated was started in August 2003 as a simple family effort to help the soldiers in one Army unit, thus the name. However, due to overwhelming requests, on January 1, 2004, the Annie Soldier effort was expanded so it would include any member of any of the armed services in harm's way. Won't you please help? Find out how by going to www.anniesoldier.com today.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being from time to time by one of the forces of nature in the national security arena. She is Elaine Donnelly, the founder and president of an indispensable organization, the Center for Military Readiness. She has been truly a keeper of the flame on the question of the culture of the United States military, something that most of us who have no experience of it firsthand either don't know anything about or don't appreciate its importance. Elaine Donnelly does, and she has been leading the fight to protect it from, well, social experimentation and political machinations of one kind or another for many years. Notably, as a member of the Defense Advisory Committee on Women in the Services, Stakowitz, and Elaine, it's always a privilege to, as I say, have you with us to talk about the important issues, and I can't think of a better time to do it than in the immediate aftermath of Memorial Day, because the people who serve need your voice and need it heard loud and clear. We're glad to be able to give you a platform for doing it. Welcome back.
Well, thank you for all the kind words. And yes, Memorial Day was kind of a sad one in many ways because of what's happening in the Middle East with the fights that went on, the people who were killed, their families, how they must feel. Yes, it's a very sobering event any year, but especially this year. And I hope that people will start to think about just how important the armed forces are, the all-volunteer force. We are getting into a stage now where defense is not just an abstract. People are concerned about enemies. They are scared of enemies that the president doesn't seem to be worried about. And when we look at other countries, and in particular an article that was in the Washington Times today about the Israeli Defense Force, I think it's worth noting this article because it shows that in Israel they do take warfare seriously. They take their national defense seriously.
They have to. They've got no choice.
They have no choice, right. And we are not living under the threat that they are. We have no particular reason to put women in armored tanks or in the infantry or special operations forces, but we would be wise, our military leaders would be wise to see, what did the Israelis decide to do just recently? Well, they decided that they would not put women into armored tanks because the physical requirements are so very great. And this is remarkable because in this country, people have the impression, well, this is all a done deal. Women in land combat, special operations forces, no problem, piece of cake. Well, it's not turning out that way.
And that the Israelis have been doing it for years, when in fact this is not the case. This piece by Rowan Scarborough, who has been really doing incalculably impressive work on this for quite some time, Elaine, as you know, at the Washington Times, it really makes the point that much of what we think we know just ain't so. And in this case especially, it can get people killed. So as you were talking about Memorial Day, what would be particularly tragic would be were we to not only compound the losses that we've already suffered in the nation's wars, but needlessly exacerbate that by having people who simply can't cut it physically in some of these ground combat positions.
Right. I watched the concert, as we always do every year, that's broadcast on PBS, the Memorial Day concert on the Mall in Washington, D.C., and watching the young family, the two, little girl, little boy grown up now and telling their story, when you see families and the grief that they suffer, it really hits hard to think that some people may lose their lives because of policymakers who pretend that men and women are exactly the same. All the evidence is to the contrary. The British recently came out with a report saying even the so-called physical elites, women who are extra strong, they suffer injury rates at far greater rates than men do. The Israelis have recognized this. The British have recognized it. And yet in this country, we're saying, oh, it's just a career opportunity, full speed ahead. This morning, I spoke to a Navy official talking about the 25% quota that the Vice Chief of Naval Operations, Admiral Howard, wants to impose on the Navy. And I said to him, wait a minute, you're saying that a cohort of people who are known to be less strong and less deployable and a whole range of social issues come with it, you're going to have a 25% quota anyway? And he said, oh, no, it's not a quota. It's an assessment goal, or, you know, semantics like that to cover up what's really going on, a social agenda.
You know, one of my colleagues is a relatively slight-built force recon Marine, and he was telling us the other day that he was obliged on his deployments to wear between his armor and the various pieces of gear that he had to carry, his weapon and pack and so on, 125 pounds worth of material. And he didn't weigh a whole lot more than that himself. And yet he had the physical strength to do it without suffering injury and without degrading his performance, amazingly. But that just ain't so. And you mentioned the British experience, Elaine, and their study, as I understand it, came down four square against putting women in these kinds of positions. What has been the experience of our own services as they've been engaging in this kind of experimentation at the direction of the Obama administration?
Well, the research that was announced or began in 2012 has produced nothing that makes the case that women can be interchangeable with men in the combat arms. Let's look at infantry officer course run by the Marines at Quantico, Virginia. 29 women attempted that course, and we respect them for trying. None of them made it through. At Ranger training, 19 women qualified to go into the program. Actually, it was 20, and one fell out before it began. Only 8 got through part of it, but none of them made it all the way through, and they're going to recycle very soon. So where's the evidence that this is a workable proposition? It's all based on theory.
Theory and wishful thinking on the one hand, and the demands of, you know, let's face it, those generally on the left who feel this is a matter of equality and that people will not be able to rise through the ranks to the degree that they would otherwise do if they haven't had this kind of combat arms experience. And
well, that's just not true.
Speak to that point, if you would, please. But also, before we run out of time, quickly, if you could talk about the question of whether should this engineering be allowed to go forward, despite all of the evidence, women will find themselves involuntarily put in these positions.
Of course, it'll be involuntary, but I think people need to understand it isn't just my voice that's talking about this. Recently, we sent to both the Senate and House leaders a letter signed by 94 distinguished Americans, both retired military and leaders of organizations, including yourself. And the letter says to Congress, look, you need to see the research results before you allow the Pentagon to move ahead on this. It's all about oversight. But Representative Loretta Sanchez, who's going to be running for the Senate in California, she offered an amendment, it got into the House bill, saying that Congress will have no say unless you count 30 calendar days, likely in August, when this thing could be rammed through by the administration without Congress having a say. This is bad policy. It is certainly contrary to the idea of congressional oversight, the necessity, the mandate that's in the Constitution.
It is. And, you know, Elaine, what it fits into a larger pattern of, I'm afraid, is a practice of basically ceding what are fundamental constitutional responsibilities of the Congress. As you say, oversight on the one hand, but also, you know, to raise and equip the armed forces of this country, and not to take responsibility in this fashion is, well, as you said, Elaine, earlier, possibly to condemn people needlessly to their deaths because the people to their left and right simply aren't up to the job. Elaine, again, I appreciate tremendously the work you do at the Center for Military Readiness and your willingness to share with us from time to time your insights and warnings. I hope they're heeded by the Congress and look forward to talking to you about these matters in the future very soon. I look forward to talking to the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.